This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Hugh Rimmington. Welcome to The Roundtable. A foul mood has descended on Australian politics. Voters appear certain to be in a sour temper, if the New South Wales by-election in Wagga Wagga is any indication, with the Liberals seeming to have lost a seat they've held for more than 60 years. But the new sense of bitter despondency is at least as strong among the politicians themselves. The recent Liberal Party leadership stoush was described by the defeated Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, as terrorism. Julie Banks, a Liberal MP, has announced she's quitting politics and has called out the bullies. Julie Bishop, who has quit the front bench, has slammed what she has called the, quote, appalling behaviour of some of her colleagues. The new most senior female Liberal in the government, Maurice Payne, says the party has a serious problem with the lack of women. Well, bullying is not just on the coalition side. Former Labour numbers man Sam Dastyari says when it comes to getting votes in a leadership contest, threats are often the only things that work. The Prime Minister, meanwhile, Scott Morrison, says he has no truck with bullies, but also that he has received no official complaints. So, is there a culture of bullying in politics? Is it a gender issue? Can anything be done? And if not, what impact might it be having on deterring the very best people from taking on the very important work of leading the nation? At the roundtable today, Dr. Sharman Stone was in the Federal Parliament for more than 20 years, serving as a Minister for Workforce Participation in the Howard government. She got out at the last election and is now Australia's Ambassador for Women and Girls. Natalie James has recently completed a five-year term as Australia's Fair Work Ombudsman. Alex Grayson specialises in employment law at Maurice Blackburn, the law firm. And Dr. Avery Poole is Assistant Director of the Melbourne School of Government at the University of Melbourne. Welcome to all of you. And if you listening want to sound off, send us a text on 0418 226 576, or you can contact us through Twitter using the handle at Radio National. Dr. Sharman Stone, perhaps I can start with you. Do these complaints that we're hearing now of bullying in federal parliament surprise you at all?
No, not at all, Hugh. They're part and parcel of being a woman in Australian Parliament. Bullying or extreme pressure, it's because women are most vulnerable. They're typically in the most marginal seats. So they are, if you like, in the firing line when it comes to threats to their pre-selection, which you have to face every 3 years, even as a sitting member, you're pre-selection is up for grabs again. So no, this is the part and parcel of being a woman in Australia's parliament, I'm afraid to say, but it's exacerbated, of course, when you have a leadership push.
So you, by my count, I think were part of five, or you had to vote in five leadership contests between the end of the Howard era and when you left in 2016. Tell us about the intensity of those moments.
Well, of course, they're a major distraction for the policy development and prosecution of the day. If you're busy running around being courted to support one or the other of the contenders, if you're perhaps even yourself helping to get those numbers for a particular person, the business of the day, the legislation that should be pushed through, the constituents' issues, the droughts, the floods, the removal of the irrigation waters, all of that is to one side while you sort out these leadership aspirations of some, all of them men in the case of the Liberal Party. And of course, there's a collateral damage. After you've had the leadership spill and the new leaders in place, you have all of the reshuffling of the ministries. That in itself is highly stressful. It isn't a case like you'd find in the private sector where a number of new job applications go up on some media site and you say, ah, there's a whole new possibility there, something called Home Affairs, new look, let's apply for that. It's not transparent. It's all done behind doors. It's all captain's pick. That is a highly, again, stressful, debilitating, time-consuming activity. and it means you have a whole new set of public servants having to make arrangements for new incoming people. So, yes, it is a distraction, and it leaves the population, the big voting Australian population, cynical, tired, over it, quite frankly.
So in the actual crucible of the moment, when you've got a leadership contest, when the votes are being counted, when people are trying to get signatures onto petitions to take up to the leader to tear them down and all that sort of stuff, what does it actually feel like? What are the threats? Who is it who comes to you to try to get your number on one side or the other of a line?
Well, I, of course, wasn't at this last leadership spill where we actually had that unusual circumstance of names on petitions. But in the previous six or seven leadership spills I was in the parliament for, there's a lot of phone calls. There's a lot of, will you support me? And by the way, there are these opportunities for you if you support me. It's very much like
those are inducements, though, aren't they? I mean, to be offered an inducement to do something can't really be styled as bullying. It's really only if they want to, as Sam Dastyari said, it's threats that work in the final analysis. Did you ever feel threatened over a vote?
I didn't, I have to say, in terms of leadership spills. I felt threatened at other times in terms of what was being done in terms of policy decisions that would impact on my electorate, and I had to stand up, and I'm a bit infamous, I guess, for what I had to do for the RU 486 issue, for SPC, for the Murray-Darling Basin. They were other times of extreme pressure, and when you're being told always that disunity is death, and yet you can't, for your conscience, for the sake of your own electorate, go along with your party's line. That's an enormous pressure. Disunity is death, you know that. But on the other hand, you have to stand up and perhaps cross the floor or, say no publicly to something that the majority of your colleagues are going along with. That is extreme pressure. And it's probably the same pressure for men and women at that time.
Alex Grayson, if I could bring you in, you're a lawyer, you deal in this whole area of employment law. How does the law define workplace bullying?
So workplace bullying is defined under the Fair Work Act, and it's repeated unreasonable behaviour that creates a risk to health and safety. It's been one really good decision which kind of elaborated on that, because what is unreasonable isn't actually defined in the Act, and it was a long shopping list: isolation, intimidation, threats, exclusion, physical abuse. It's quite a broad, if you like, category of things that can constitute unreasonable behaviour. What it can't be is reasonable managerial action carried out in a reasonable manner. So performance management, for example, can be unreasonable if it's carried out in an unreasonable manner.
What about disagreements? Obviously, you have a real hothouse like Parliament. People are going to disagree. They can disagree passionately on issues. That wouldn't amount to bullying, presumably.
I think there's a real difference between a disagreement, appropriately voiced, and threats or intimidation. I think it is open to people in the workplace to not agree. We're all human beings. We don't all have the same view. But when it comes with, if you like, a tale of unreasonableness, that if you don't agree, then these will be the repercussions. If you don't agree, you're not going to get that promotion. If you don't agree, then you're not coming to those meetings. So it will always depend on the context. And obviously Australian Parliament's very different than perhaps the admin pool at the local YMCA. So context is crucial as well as to what is reasonable or unreasonable.
From what you've seen being alleged, would you say that you'd be concerned that there is actual workplace bullying?
Well, I'm not going to comment on what's been alleged. I can say that intimidation in the Australian workplace would potentially give rise to anti-bullying orders.
Mm. Natalie James, until recently you were Fair Work Ombudsman. Would you be concerned by what is being spoken about in the federal parliament at the moment?
Well, I mean, certainly, like Alex, I'm not in a position to comment on what's gone on. I mean, I'm reading the papers like everybody else. I guess what I would say is just, it's striking, isn't it, that comment from the Prime Minister, I've received no official complaints. Well, where does a a parliamentarian go to complain? And where are the rules set out for conduct? So these people aren't employees. They're not in the, I don't think they're in the Fair Work Commission's jurisdiction. It would be fascinating if they popped up there with an application for an anti-bullying order. Do they go to the Prime Minister? Is there a code of conduct? I was a public servant for over 20 years, and it was very clear that there was a code of conduct that applied to public servants. And that code of conduct makes it very clear you must treat everyone with respect and courtesy and without harassment.
So that's a public servant, but has there been any attempt to formalise rules, to your knowledge, for MPs and senators?
Well, it's interesting. I appeared before Senate Estimates Committees for about 15 years, and you know, there are rules there. For example, there's a guide for witnesses that says that you must treat the members asking you questions with respect, but there's nothing that suggests that the respect needs to go the other way. So I don't believe there's a framework. And I mean, we need to be careful. It's not all about rules. But most workplaces have policies. Most workplaces have a code of conduct. They set out, here is how we expect people to behave here. If you think of the system of parliament, it is so combative. It is so adversarial. Where do people look to their models for behaviour? If they're looking to question time or even Senate estimates, then that's not a great model. And I think Julie Bishop talked about the theatre of politics and question time. And so, you know, where is it being made clear what is and isn't acceptable in this environment, which in the end is a workplace? It's a workplace not just for those politicians, those members of parliament, but for all of the public service members and all the members of the parliamentary services who work there.
I have a message that's been texted in from a listener, Sue, who says, why on earth would a woman want to enter politics today? Perhaps I can bring you in, Dr. Avery Poole from the Melbourne School of Government. You have among your students people who obviously are considering a career in politics or interested in the process. Do you get a sense that people, particularly young women, are put off by what they've been seeing?
Well, I think we are very concerned that talented, competent women who are doing amazing things and have passionate views about policy positions and contemporary issues facing us in Australia and the world may be dissuaded from running for elected office. And this is obviously a concern. We don't want people who have a lot to contribute feeling as if the workplace, the environment will not be welcoming to them. That's definitely a concern. Having said that, I think that the incidents that have been alleged in recent weeks and the general evidence about the sort of hothouse environment of Canberra hopefully will light a fire in the belly of some women to go ahead anyway. But I think we do need to take a serious look at the culture and the context. And I think a key thing is that we need to take seriously the fact that women are still in a minority, particularly in federal parliament. There's about 30% of federal parliamentarians are women, and it's lower in the lower house at about 27%. So, you know, this is a concern because I think that if we had more women in federal parliament, we would have we would be able to change the context, change the conversation, hopefully make it less acceptable for the sort of behaviour that has been alleged recently. But also, it's not democratic to have a parliament that is not representative of the wider population. So women should be encouraged to participate in political life. Partly because it's democratic to have a representative parliament.
No doubt about that. We also heard there from Sharman Stone saying that women tend to be in the more marginal seats. Is there, in a sense, a kind of institutionalised bullying in the fact that women can't get in there? It's almost a gender bullying issue.
Well, again, I'm sort of a little bit reluctant to kind of comment directly when there's a lot of allegations that presumably some of which will be investigated. But I think the general environment, that there's suggestions that it's not particularly welcoming to women who may have a lot to add. So we have a program at the moment at the university called Pathways to Politics, where women who do want to run for office and may not feel as if they have been able to really developed the skills or have been able to navigate the party machinery as yet. We're focusing on ways to help them develop those skills and be able to deal with things like the scrutiny of personal lives and so forth. But I think it's a really major concern, and we see Julie Bishop's comments recently. A senior member of cabinet until recently. Once she's made these comments, I think we need to take really seriously the suggestion that really talented women might not want to run for politics. And it's also the case, I think, that young people in general, there is a common misconception, I think, that young people are apathetic or they're disenchanted with democracy and politics. But I think what we find, what research by colleagues of mine at the university have found, is that young people are definitely passionate. It's just that they're sceptical about party politics because they see the you know, sometimes the circus of Question Time. They see what's reported in the news, which of course is not everything that goes on in Canberra. And some of them are concerned that elected office is not going to really make a difference, that it's going to become about party politics. And so they are engaging, but they're potentially engaging in ways that are outside formal politics. And I think that's a concern because formal politics is still the place where we make policy.
Ultimately make the decisions. You're listening to The Roundtable on RN. Dr. Sharman Stone, you've just been listening there to Avery Paul and reflecting on the views of younger Australians after 20 years in politics as a woman.
Yes.
Was it worth it? Would you counsel others to do the same?
I have to say, Hugh, every day I was a member, and I'm not exaggerating, it was a pleasure, a privilege and an honour to serve in the Australian Parliament. It was a privilege because we have a great democracy. We're probably still the most stable, continuous, oldest democracy on earth. But I had a very sad experience when I decided not to recontest the last election. I approached a number of highly competent women who I thought should run for pre-selection for my seat. And I was just rejected each time. Women said, why would we? We know too much about what we have to sacrifice in terms of our own families, our life, work-life balance. We know, for example, the social media will descend upon us, particularly because we're women. They will be besieged by ugly, anonymous trolls. We don't want to have to compromise our values. They thought that you had to lose your integrity to become a member of parliament, which I thought was very sad. And, of course, that's not true. And in the end, I only had one woman candidate out of the nine going for pre-selection for the seat of Murray, my old seat. Now, I think that's a serious problem, as so other speakers have said. I really do think that there are solutions. One is, we have a toxic set of processes and procedures in Parliament that have evolved over time that do bring about this combative, macho, disrespectful environment in Parliament. It's not just Question Time, which is a circus in itself. And it was just, I feel almost humiliated sometimes sitting in Question Time for what was going on. But it's also this thing called the Matter of Public Importance debate that occurs each day, but Friday, where it's the same story. It's just vindictive, thrown across the chamber at each other. The fact that ministers can't speak on their constituent issues in the party room or in Parliament, that removes them from the people who actually vote for them in the House of Representatives.
Can I just ask you, sorry to cut across you there, when you were looking around for someone to take over your seat or to run for the seat, I understand that you'd want to get a woman in there. Did you get a sense, though, that men might be equally or almost as much put off by political life now had you been taking a straw poll of them?
No, I didn't find men were as put off by what we'll call the aggression, the mindless aggression of the parliamentary process. A lot of, perhaps they're socialised. Men are socialised not to complain about the biffo on the footy field, but in fact to see that part of the entertainment. I think women are more likely, we're socialised to be more collegiate, to want to cut through to the issues, to be focused on our own constituents, and women make superb marginal seat workers, for example. We know that. They're more likely to succeed in a marginal seat because of the effort they put into the everyday issues of their their voters. So no, men were rarely said to me, we're not prepared to sacrifice our family life for this, because men typically aren't carrying into Parliament still the burden of the unpaid work carer workload, the responsibility for children and for perhaps aged parents. Men often have a wife who's going to iron their shirts and look after them and be their backstops when they go into Parliament, whereas for women it's much harder for men to act as a supporting spouse and not feel all the strains of other men saying, well, look at you, you know, you're no longer the king of your household. There's a lot of those issues for women that are different when it comes to men. And I think that's got to change, not just in Parliament, obviously, but across our society.
So if we were to look at ways in which things could change, sometimes the law helps in these places. We've seen right now, in fact, Sarah Hanson-Young, the Green senator, is in the act of suing the Liberal Democrat Senator David Lionhelm after some fairly appalling stuff was said across the chamber. Alex Grayson, do you see an option for politicians to actually use the civil law to change anything?
I think it's unclear currently as to, as Natalie has said earlier, as to what kind of rights or remedies these politicians might have. I was actually turning my mind to this question last night. One of my thoughts, when I was sitting drinking a bottle of wine with a bunch of girlfriends, one of my thoughts was whether there might be some sort of parliamentary committee that could be set up that would investigate complaints. I don't like this idea of it being dealt with in party. It smacks of these things not really being dealt with. So turning my mind to that, what we were thinking about was some sort of parliamentary committee that would actually review these things, take it seriously. And if there was a fear that these things would be independently, or as independently as it can be with parliamentarians, reviewed, there might actually be a cultural shift if there is a cultural problem. So that was where I was thinking of. I think the legal position of parliamentarians in Australia and how they fit into civil laws, I think, is probably right on the very edges. And I think what Sarah Hanson-Young has been looking at is whether there's some sort of defamation action. And that's a rich man's sport, if I could call it that.
Yeah. They're crowdfunding, I think, on both sides for the money for that. Natalie James, as an ex-Fair Work Ombudsman, do you see legal remedies?
Look, I think it's fair to say the legal remedies, even for your normal average worker, are a bit confusing. Alex pointed out the Fair Work Commission jurisdiction earlier. In addition, sometimes these matters can go under workplace health and safety frameworks. But they have to hit this. They have to fit those criteria. They have to be repeated. You have to be an employee. They have to tip the health and safety sort of criteria. If bullying is going on for a motive that is discriminatory, like because a person is a woman or of a certain race or religion, then the Human Rights Commission might have a role. I would say there's fragmentation in the legal framework already around how to deal with this. And as far as parliamentarians go, I guess I'd be asking the question, you know, should there be a code of conduct for the treatment of politicians and the way they engage with others, not just about their interests and what have you? And I'm aware that in the parliament there have been attempts to look at this question. There was a Senate committee that examined the question of a code of conduct in 2012. In 1995, there was a draft framework of ethical principles developed by the Speaker, and it doesn't appear to have gone very far. And so I guess maybe now's a good time to be dusting these documents off and asking ourselves the question, perhaps if we start with the frameworks, what behaviour do we expect in this place, this most significant place in our democracy, our Parliament, and what sort of behaviour do we want to be conveying to the country and indeed the world about how our most senior political leaders engage with one another and others in that environment.
Avery Poole from the Melbourne School of Government, any ideas you've got to improve the game?
Well, do you mean in regard to the legal situation or just in terms of the culture?
Whether it is legal, whether it is through the suggestion that we heard from Alex Grayson there, that perhaps there could be a parliamentary committee to which people can take their complaints and seek to have them resolved somehow in a sort of a multi-partisan way. I don't know if that's even remotely possible.
Yeah. I think that's definitely an interesting suggestion. And obviously, Sharman Stone is much better qualified to comment on that than me. But I think that that what we hear from women is that they're particularly concerned about the culture within major political parties. So the idea that Alex put forward of a parliamentary committee that's somehow trying to sit above or separate from the parties, I think is a really appealing one. But again, I'll go back to my point that I think we just need to see more women in Canberra generally, and not just in elected positions, but also among political staffers and in the media as well, in the press gallery. There's been some evidence some media around treatment of journalists that are also only about one third in Canberra. And Karen Middleton's made some comments about experiences that she's had while working in Canberra. So I think certainly we have to think in terms of where people working in politics can go if they have allegations of inappropriate workplace behaviour to make. But we also have to go back to foundational questions of the fact that there's just not enough women in Canberra.
Sharman Stone, you've been in the belly of the beast.
Indeed, Hugh, and I think there is one move that we can make. And it always astounds me that in our Australian Parliament, we have never had, as far as I can find out, a women's caucus, a cross-party women's group who identify these sorts of problems and issues, and together, using their numbers, which, as we keep saying, are not enough and going down and are a shame for our country. If we had a women's caucus who could, say, for example, identify the hours of work or time that we spend in Parliament, just so unfamily friendly. We start on average about 7:30. We can't rise till 9. That's more than a 12-hour day. We have so much time wasting in Parliament. Imagine if we abolished question time as we know it, also the MPIs each day in the House of Reps. You'd have 3 hours spare per day where women and men with families could go home to their accommodation in Canberra, to their preschool age toddlers, and have some family interaction, be with their partners perhaps, and so on. These women's caucuses work like this in most other developed country democracies. But in Australia, we're so hell-bent on kicking the other party, other major party, to death, that when women do get together, and I've seen this in my time in Parliament, if some women in a bipartisan way do go speak together in a coffee shop, or and there's strict division when you eat up in the members' dining room, members' senators' dining room, you never can sit with the other parties, for example. But when you might sneak off and do that, there's great suspicion about what is going on. If we had that gender-based caucus, there could be some real action, I think.
It might make a difference. Thanks to Dr. Sharman Stone, a former federal parliamentarian for more than 20 years, Natalie James is Australia's former Fair Work Ombudsman, Alex Grayson is from the law firm Maurice Blackburn, and Dr. Avery Paul is from the Melbourne School of Government at the University of Melbourne. That's all we have time for. Thanks for listening. I'm Hugh Remington. Until next week.